From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. As the demand for oil increases and prices rise, political and military alliances are being redrawn, with oil-rich countries like Russia and Venezuela gaining power. Journalist Michael Clare calls it the new international energy order. On today's Fresh Air, we'll talk with him about his new book. Also, the executive producer of The Daily Show, David Javerbaum, and the bassist and songwriter of the band Fountains of Wayne, Adam Schlesinger, teamed up to write the songs for the new Broadway musical Crybaby. It's an adaptation of the John Waters movie. They'll talk with our rock critic, Ken Tucker. And linguist Jeff Nunberg defends the word That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Political and military alliances are getting redrawn according to who has oil and gas and who needs it. Michael Clare calls this the new international energy order. He says in this new order, Russia, once the bruised, battered, poverty-stricken loser of the Cold War, has emerged as an imperious power broker of Eurasian energy supplies. The U.S., not long ago billed as the world's unchallenged superpower, has become distressingly dependent on foreign oil suppliers, who, in President Bush's words, do not share our interests. China and India are rising economic giants competing with older powers for energy resources. Michael Clare is the author of the new book, Rising Powers, Shrinking Planet, The New Geopolitics of Energy. He's the defense analyst for The Nation and director of the Five College Program in Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College. Russia is very rich in oil right now and is doing quite well economically because of it, oil and gas. So is that creating a stronger connection between the United States and Russia or driving us further apart?
Well, this has been a big disappointment for the Bush administration, Terry. When the Soviet Union broke apart and Boris Yeltsin was president, American companies saw a great prospect of developing Russian oil and gas and bringing that to this country. And American companies did develop contracts for the development of oil and gas projects, especially off of Russia's far eastern coast, off of Sakhalin Island. But when Vladimir Putin moved in to replace Boris Yeltsin, he took a much more jaundiced look at American companies developing these resources. Nonetheless, President Bush made a strenuous effort in the months after 9/11 to forge an energy partnership with Vladimir Putin. He met with him several times and forged what was called the U.S.-Russian Energy Partnership. And there was talk of close cooperation between the two countries. Sad to say, all of this has come to naught because Putin has made a very vigorous effort to take possession, repossess all of these assets that were privatized by Yeltsin and bring them under state control, really to make Gazprom, the state-owned natural gas monopoly, the central mechanism of control over all of Russia's oil and gas assets. And American companies have more or less been frozen out of Russian energy assets. And so none of these endeavors by President Bush have gone anywhere, and it doesn't look very promising for the future. European companies have also found a very disappointing prospects. Shell was lost its majority ownership of the Sakhalin 2 project. BP is finding a very difficult time. So this hasn't proved very successful endeavor.
So as the United States and European countries are being shut out by Russia, what are some of the countries that Russia is forming alliances with because of energy?
Well, this is really what I highlight in my book, the changing landscape of world energy. The older energy powers, mainly the Western countries, the United States, Europe, and Japan, which once dominated the world energy trade, are now being shoved aside by state-owned companies in the oil-producing countries, Russia and the Middle Eastern countries and Venezuela and now the African countries. Their state-owned companies, known as national oil companies or NOCs, are forming partnerships among them. So the Russian companies, Gazprom, and other state-owned companies are forming alliances with state-owned companies in the Middle East, with Iran, and in some cases with Chinese companies. There's talk now of a natural gas OPEC among the natural gas producers. Russia is the world's leading natural gas producer. Iran is number two. Qatar is number three. And there have been talk among them to form a OPEC-like cartel of these leading natural gas producers. This represents a real shift in the world balance of power between the older energy producers and these new state-controlled oil-producing companies.
The companies that have nationalized their oil industries and now have like state-run oil industries, are these countries not only forming energy alliances with each other, are they forming military alliances with each other? And if so, what are a couple of the most significant ones?
Yes, they certainly are forming military as well as energy alliances. Perhaps the most interesting example of this is the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, or SCO. This is an alliance forged by China and Russia in 1996, and it includes those two countries, plus the Central Asian states of Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, and Tajikistan. Most of these countries are energy producers, Russia, Uzbekistan, and Kazakhstan, and this has a security dimension. They are all pledged to cooperate with one another in opposing terrorism and foreign enemies, but it's also designed to cooperate in energy security and protecting their energy infrastructure. And it's a vehicle for supplying weapons to these countries and to cooperate in defending their very vulnerable pipelines. And it has become increasingly militarized and anti-American. They've adopted a call for the United States to abandon its bases in the area and to stay out. This is a very disturbing development.
At the risk of asking the obvious, what's the most disturbing aspects of it?
What I find disturbing about this is the degree to which energy on a global scale is taking on a kind of a Cold War element, that the U.S., China, and Russia are viewing energy as the basis of a global power struggle. It's not just in Central Asia, it's in the Middle East and in Africa. Just this year, the United States created the U.S. Africa Command, the first new overseas regional command to be developed in 25 years since the Central Command was created in the Middle East. And that command was established after Russia invaded Afghanistan, and it was created for the purpose of protecting Middle East oil. Now we have a new Africa Command, and its purpose, I believe, is to protect African oil against the growing presence in Africa of the Chinese and their pursuit of African oil. The military won't say this, Terry. You know, if you ask them, they'll deny that. But I think if you look at the history of the formation of this new command, it reflects growing concern about America's dependence on African oil.
So where does Iran figure into the new energy alliances that are being formed now?
As you know, Terry, the United States is deeply concerned about Iran's looming military presence in the Persian Gulf. Iran is also a major energy supplier. It has the second largest reserves of oil and natural gas in the world, and it is a major supplier of oil to China. And it is majorly dependent on Russia as a supplier of arms, and Vladimir Putin was recently in Iran and promised to increase its supply of arms to Iran, and China has been supplying Iran with missiles and missile technology. So this is an indication, again, of how these energy relationships are increasingly being militarized.
One of your concerns is that because energy relationships are becoming increasingly militarized, that an accidental war, an inadvertent war, might break out. What kind of scenario do you have in mind?
I think very much of the period before World War I, when the major world powers were jockeying for influence in some of the same areas of the world, by the way, in Central Asia and Africa, for geopolitical influence, and they became deeply involved in local conflicts, and again were providing arms and advisors and deploying troops, and got overly involved in these disputes, and these local conflicts provided the sparks for clashes between the forces of the opposing sides. That's what I worry about, that you could have American and Russian or American and Chinese troops caught up overnight, inadvertently, in a local dispute without anybody really planning for this to happen. We have troops in Kyrgyzstan. We have troops in Georgia within miles of Russian bases, almost in sighting distance of Russian bases. And both of those countries have the potential for ethnic wars that could blow up overnight and inadvertently trigger a shooting match between U.S. and Russian troops. Nobody would plan for this, but it could happen.
My guest is Michael Clare. He's the author of the new book, Rising Powers, Shrinking Planet, The New Geopolitics of Energy. And he's the defense correspondent for The Nation and director of the Five College Program in Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College in Amherst. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Michael Clare, and he's written a new book called Rising Powers, Shrinking Planet, The New Geopolitics of Energy. He's a defense correspondent for The Nation and director of the Five College Program in Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College in Amherst, Massachusetts. You've talked a little bit about the national oil companies, the countries that have nationalized their oil industries. Now, the United States certainly hasn't done that. On the other hand, you point out that the United States has increasingly politicized its energy policy.
Militarized.
Okay, give me an example of what you mean.
Well, I talk about the formation of AFRICOM in Africa, the new U.S. military command for the African continent. We are supplying increasing amounts of military assistance to Nigeria, to Angola, to Equatorial Guinea, to other oil-producing countries in Africa. And when you look at the congressional justification for why we're doing it, the Pentagon and the Bush administration say it's because we're fearful that unrest and insurgency in Africa will threaten the supply of oil to the United States. An area of particular concern is the Niger Delta region of Nigeria, where there is a very active insurgency underway. Nigeria is expected to be the leading supplier of oil in Africa to the United States, possibly the leading supplier of oil from anywhere in the world to the United States. So the fact that there's a insurgency there is of great concern, and we're increasingly helping the Nigerian government to suppress that insurgency.
I want to talk to you about Venezuela a little bit.
Sure.
I think it's hard for people in the United States to think about how powerful Venezuela has become, largely because of its oil. And Venezuela is one of the countries that has a national oil company. It's mostly state-run. How is oil affecting Venezuela's power?
Venezuela's power stems from both its oil. Remember, Venezuela is still one of the major suppliers of oil to the United States, despite all of the bad language that gets hurled back and forth between our two countries. Venezuela still provides us with about 1.5 million barrels of oil a day, and we rely on that. But it's also the money. The high price of oil has given Hugo Chavez billions of dollars that he can use to influence politics in Latin America and in his own country. He's used it for social programs that has given him great popularity in his country. And he's also supported social programs throughout Latin America that has equaled or exceeded the kind of aid that the United States provides. So he looks very appealing to many people in Latin America at a time when the United States does not look very appealing. So it's both the oil and the money that oil provides.
Meanwhile, Hugo Chavez hates President Bush. I said incredibly insulting things about him. So where do you see the relationship headed now between the United States and Venezuela, and how does that affect our future using their oil?
The fact is that both the U.S. and Venezuela are mutually dependent on each other. That's the odd fact. It's like a dysfunctional marriage, and neither one of us can afford to sever that relationship. It would be devastating for Venezuela, and it would be devastating for the United States, maybe less for us than for them. But even so, given the high price of oil today and the need for every single barrel of oil that we can get our hands on, neither of us wants to break that relationship. So I would imagine, especially if there's a Democratic president in a year from now, that efforts will be made to get some marriage counseling.
5 years after the United States invaded Iraq, I'm wondering what you think now in terms of how much oil figured into the motivation behind the invasion.
Well, I've always said, Terry, that the invasion of Iraq was not about Iraq's oil per se, as some people have claimed. Instead, that it was consistent with the Carter Doctrine of 1980, which says that it is in America's vital interests to dominate the Persian Gulf region and protect the flow of oil from the entire region in order to make sure that the United States and its allies have access to that area's oil, which is two-thirds of the world's oil, and that Saddam Hussein posed a threat, a serious threat, to control of the entire area. And this is exactly what Dick Cheney said at the time before the invasion, that armed with weapons of mass destruction, Saddam Hussein would pose a threat to the free flow of oil and therefore had to be removed. And I think that George Bush believes that that's what he accomplished in Iraq.
So how do you think the war 5 years after it started is affecting the free flow of oil in the region?
I would say that it's mixed results. From that perspective alone, it's mixed results. You have eliminated one of the regimes that posed a potential threat. On the other hand, you've created a black hole of instability and chaos that could potentially create threats of ethnic warfare and religious warfare that could spread to the other countries in the form of sabotage to oil facilities. So I think the results are mixed.
The Navy, the U.S. Navy, is establishing a command and control facility on top of an offshore Iraqi oil platform in the Persian Gulf. What's the purpose of this?
This facility is to protect the loading facilities. This is in Basra, and just recently, as you know, the government of Prime Minister al-Maliki attempted to clear the port area of militias and other hostile elements. The Basra is the main port for the export of Iraqi oil, and there's been a lot of criminal and militia activity that has severely disrupted the export of Iraqi oil. And so this command and control facility you're referring to is part of an effort by the U.S. and the Iraqi government to protect future exports of Iraqi oil against sabotage, theft, corruption, and all of the rest. Americans may not be aware that a lot of the losses of Iraqi oil is not to insurgency, but to theft and corruption.
There was an article recently in the New York Times that at least one-third of the fuel from Iraq's largest refinery is being diverted to the black market. And this is according to American military officials. Tankers are being hijacked, drivers bribed, papers forged, meters manipulated, and some of the money's going to insurgents.
That's right. The current situation in Iraq is one in which the insurgency has been to some degree contained, but the degree of lawlessness and corruption is so great. And the oil industry, of course, is the only source of wealth in this country. There is no other source of wealth. So there's tremendous fighting between the different factions over who will control the revenues generated by oil and who controls the flow from the refineries to the gas stations and all of that. Some of it is very violent. And that's what the fighting in Basra was really all about.
About oil?
About control over the black market trade. Who's going to control it? Is the Iraqi government going to control it? Is this militia going to control it? Is Sadr's militia going to control it? It's really inter-warlord corruption.
Michael Clare will be back in the second half of the show. His new book is called Rising Powers, Shrinking Planet, The New Geopolitics of Energy. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from the Pew Charitable Trusts, whose new Economic Mobility Project report examines federal spending on economic mobility at pewtrusts.org. From Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of All Saints, about redemption, humor, and maturing at age 50 by Liam Callanan, author of The Cloud Atlas. And from the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness. On the web at melvilletrust.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm a bad girl, bad as I can be.
That's music from the soundtrack of John Waters' film Crybaby. Coming up, David Javerbaum of The Daily Show and Adam Schlesinger of the band Fountains of Wayne talk about writing the songs for the new Broadway adaptation. Also, linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the useful work done by the word and more with Michael Clare.
Trouble always follows me. I killed myself a black cat just the night before. Sprinkle a little goofy dust all around my door. Hoping I'd chase some people. Stories said that you'd be good, but I just found out that that you wouldn't if you could. I'm tired of you driving, don't want you anymore.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Michael Clare. His new book is about how political and military alliances are getting redrawn according to who has oil and who needs it. He calls this the new international energy order. His new book is called Rising Powers, Shrinking Planet, The New Geopolitics of Energy. Clare is the defense correspondent for The Nation and the director of the Five College Program in Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College in Amherst. Let me bring up China here. China has been so much in the news now because of the Olympics and the crackdown on Tibet. China has a huge population. It really needs a lot of energy. What about China as an energy supplier? Does it have much energy resources within its own country?
Well, this is the great challenge, and for the entire planet, China does have one source of energy in abundance, and that's coal. China is the world's leading user of coal, and it intends to use much more coal in the future. By the year 2030, it's expected that China will use half of the world's coal. And unfortunately, China intends to use, you know, kind of primitive, by modern standards, primitive coal-burning facilities to generate electricity. And if this continues to be the case, we are all hostage on the planet to China's coal use, because this will be the leading source of greenhouse gas producing carbon dioxide emissions. And there will be no hope of averting the worst global climate change disasters. So we have all got to work with China. This is really a catastrophic phenomenon. We have got to work with China to either abandon its reliance on coal or to adopt more modern, less, you know, carbon dioxide emitting coal facilities.
You literally think that the United States should be doing some kind of joint project with China to develop alternative energy. What are the odds of something like that actually happening?
Well, you know, we used to think, Terry, of national security, meaning, you know, building up nuclear weapons for a possible war with China. We have to think of our national security as working with China not to burn coal at the rate they're doing, because our survival on the planet is at risk from this. And if we grasp this reality, yes, I think that we will understand the necessity of cooperating with China in developing energy alternatives. It's a matter of survival.
You know, we've been talking about energy and how it's realigning political and military connections around the world. Gas has risen about 80% at the pumps in the past year. And, you know, the oil companies have recently made huge profits. What's the correlation between the rise in gas prices and the profits at the energy companies? Is it the profits that's behind the rise in prices? Is it something else?
The rise in gasoline prices, Terry, are really a combination of factors. Partly, it's simply the fact that the production of oil is not keeping pace with worldwide demand. But on top of that, you have the fact that the oil companies, the private oil companies, which no longer produce much of the world's oil in comparison to the state-owned oil companies, now are mainly in the business of selling oil, of refining it, distributing it, and marketing it, and they're the beneficiaries of the rising price of crude oil. They take the profit off of the rising price of crude. They then double that in the refining and distribution and marketing part of the process, and they get all of the profit from that.
You know, your book is called Rising Power, Shrinking Planet, and one of the main points of the book is that there's a greater and greater demand for oil and gas as countries, huge countries like India and China, become more and more industrialized, and there's more demand for cars and automobiles. And at the same time, energy supplies are shrinking. So what kind of recipe is that creating?
Well, I think this is what's really behind the rising prices we see at the pump, for example, because all of a sudden you have hundreds of millions of new consumers in China and India who are buying their first car, and they're buying gasoline-powered cars. So there's a huge increase in demand. Well, that's half the equation, Terry. The other half is the fact that the oil companies are searching for new oil fields to satisfy all of this demand, and they're not finding any. We're just not finding giant new oil fields like the ones that we found in the 1940s and 50s and 60s, like the Mammoth Ghawar oil field in Saudi Arabia that still produces a very large supply of world demand. We're not finding these new oil fields. So the world supply is not keeping pace with demand, and that's pushing up the price of oil. And this appears to be the trend for as far as we could see into the future, which means these higher prices are likely to persist indefinitely.
Well, Michael Clara, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure, Terry, always.
Michael Clara is the author of the new book, Rising Powers, Shrinking Planet. Coming up, David Javerbaum of The Daily Show and Adam Schlesinger of Fountains of Wayne talk about writing the songs for the new Broadway adaptation of the John Waters movie Crybaby. This is Fresh Air. After the successful adaptation of John Waters' film Hairspray into a hit Broadway musical, a musical adaptation of another Waters film, Crybaby, opens next week on Broadway. In the movie, Johnny Depp had one of his first starring roles as a juvenile delinquent in 1954 named Crybaby Walker, who falls in love with a high society girl. Comic cultural clashes ensue. Our guests were brought in to write the songs for the new show. It's the first time they've worked together. David Javerbaum has won 8 Emmy Awards as a writer for The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. He's currently the show's executive producer. Adam Schlesinger is the co-leader of the pop rock band Fountains of Wayne, perhaps best known for their 2003 hit single, Stacy's Mom. He was nominated for an Oscar for Best Original Song for the title tune of the 1996 movie That Thing You Do. And he wrote some of the songs for the film Music and Lyrics. Before we hear the interview they recorded with Fresh Air's rock critic Ken Tucker, let's hear one of their songs from Crybaby.
The stars up above shine their light on our love, and the night just like us is still young. And it's long and it's slow, and I need to know, girl, can I kiss you with tongue? Moist and it's pink, it's a muscle.
David Javerbaum and Adam Schlesinger, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So going into this project, were there things that you said to yourself based on the shows that you'd seen that you really, things you really wanted to make sure you got into your show, or things you wanted very specifically to avoid?
Well, there's a certain well-known show about somebody in a leather jacket in the 50s that does fairly well, I'm told, and we were very aware of that show. You know, we just wanted to be sure that we were taking a totally different tone, you know, to similar material. And one thing we would ask is, like, is this something that would be in Greece? And if the answer...
What's Greece? You lost me.
So if the answer was yes, then we wouldn't want to do it. Not because Greece is bad, but because it's been done. And we don't want to do that. It's just we want to do something that's completely different.
So the big You're the Crybaby That I Want, that song got scrapped.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. When we think of 50s rock, when this period is set in this show, I think we think of Elvis and Little Richard and Chuck Berry, but you also had to write songs for the kind of people that your female lead, Allison, hung out with, kind of bland pop music that at the time was epitomized by singers like Pat Boone or Connie Francis or somewhat more interesting harmony groups like the Four Freshmen. In Crybaby, that music is performed by the squarest characters, this four-part harmony group that call themselves the Wiffles.
Yes.
There's a song that I really like that's kind of their manifesto called Squeaky Clean. Could you describe that song?
Squeaky Clean, is, as you said, is their manifesto. It's a song that they're singing at a talent show. And the best way to describe it, the first verse is, squeaky clean, that's what they call us. Our thoughts are pure and our grooming is flawless. We're well-bred, well-mannered, and, well, just nice. And when you rub our hair, it sounds like mice. And it's just that, you know, and it's something I wanted to write something. We wanted to write something that they could say and be proud of unironically and that we would find funny ironically. And that's a common thing that we tried to do. And it's fun to do it if you can do it. It's tricky.
I mean, actually, the opening number of our show is split into two halves, one half for the Squares and then one half for the Drapes, who come on stage and kind of take over. And I think that's a very different way to open the show from what people might be expecting if they think it's, you know, a sequel to Hairspray or a prequel to Hairspray or something, because, you know, Hairspray starts with like a big high energy thing. We actually open our show with the squarest possible song where they're singing about this anti-polio picnic that they're having, and you know, all the Squares are gathered around to get their polio shots, and
it's not low energy, but it's not rockabilly yet. I mean, yeah. it's very sort of big Hollywood movie opening, but the tone of it is odd in that we're celebrating an anti-polio picnic, and then somebody comes out with an iron lung and laments that he didn't get a polio shot. So it's a little bit askew, and hopefully that will be a signal to the audience that we're playing around with them a little bit.
Yeah, and I should mention you used the term Drapes, which I wasn't familiar with till I saw the movie, and I guess John Waters has explained that that's a kind of Baltimore term for hoods or hoodlums.
That's right.
Yeah.
We'd never heard of that term either before this project, but that is correct.
But it's a good word because you can rhyme a lot with it, I guess, I would think.
I don't actually think we rhyme Drapes anywhere on the show.
Oh, okay.
I don't. You're right.
I knew we forgot something.
I don't think we did. But, you know, looking back, maybe we should have had a song about grapes. And that clearly would
have. Or crepes.
Yeah, or crepes. And that would have been fun.
John Waters is listed in the credits as creative consultants. And I always take that as code for never set foot in the theater before opening night. Am I wrong?
Yeah.
You're wrong, Ken.
Good.
You're absolutely wrong.
Good.
No,
Tell me how wrong I am.
He's been involved sporadically throughout the entire process, more so as he's gotten closer and closer to this point. He is really among the smartest people I've ever met. And the notes that he gives, you know, he's not proprietary. He's not trying to recreate the movie. He recognizes it's a different form. And his notes are just so smart and focused, and we pretty much always take them. But he doesn't force them on us. I mean, he's a real gentleman, and you know, it's been a pleasure to work with him and to get to know him.
And did he ever say that could be a little racier? That could be a little more John Watersy.
Oh, well, he never says anything should be more John Watersy, but yeah. He does say that things should be racier, things should be campier. Well, he doesn't use the word campy either, actually. No. But he's very. He's very focused on whether the tone of a scene is right, whether the tone of a character is right. And those are the kind of notes he gives more often than not. You know, he doesn't micromanage, and he doesn't tell anybody that a line should be this instead of this, or a melody should be this instead of this. He just, if it feels wrong to him in general, that's what he'll say.
My guests are David Javerbaum and Adam Schlesinger. They've written the music for the new Broadway show, Crybaby. Two songs in the show in particular seem to me to be kind of polar opposites stylistically. One is a kind of rockin' party song that's sort of an homage to Eddie Cochran that's called Baby, 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 and then in parentheses in my playbill, it says Baby, Baby, Baby.
That's a typo.
That's a typo.
It's supposed to be five babies, five then babies. Parentheses, then two babies.
Yeah, we apologize. We're furious about that.
And what I really like is that it consists almost entirely of that one word. It's almost a sort of an anti-Broadway show tune in that it's very kind of Ramonesy almost. It's very, you know, it's very kind of punk rock sort of.
Well, I mean, one of the things that we talked about when we first started working on this show is, you know, rockabilly music is not exactly the most musically complex genre, shall we say. And so we said, well, how are we going to do this? We have to write a whole show with rockabilly songs. I mean, it's like a genre where, you know, if you use a third chord, you're almost breaking the rules sometimes. And so, you know, that's a song where we actually are playing with the fact that some of those songs are just so incredibly simple.
We just embraced it on that one. And I think the essence of rock and roll is the word baby. I think that's pretty much it.
Although for a little while in the 70s, it was actually changed to mama.
Yes.
And they went back to baby.
It was mama. That's right.
Come on, get up here, Allison.
But I don't know the words.
Baby, 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 baby.
The other song, which I think is kind of the opposite, is the one that's sung by Harriet Harris. You know, in a show that doesn't have many big names in its cast, I think Harriet Harris might be known to many of our listeners as Frasier's agent Beebe in the TV show Frasier. She plays the grandmother of your female lead, the self-proclaimed conservative Episcopalian, and she has this big solo number called "I Did Something Wrong Once," which she lets loose with her own set of reasons about why people don't get her, to use crybaby's terminology. Was that a challenge to write that kind of real? That struck me as, in a way, the most traditional sort of Broadway showstopper.
Yeah, that is a traditional kind of 11 o'clock number. No, it wasn't. I mean, with that lyric, I was just trying to give voice to somebody who reluctantly admitting to having made one mistake in her life. And, you know, the journey of the song, so to speak, is to go from not admitting it to admitting it and preparing to rectify it, but still having only admitted to one mistake in your life. And it's, you know, it's written in a very... Yeah, it's much more literate and complicated lyrically than "Baby, Baby, 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 Baby," as is pretty much every song in the world. By the way, I want to hasten to add that we're talking about these songs that we rewrote. Like these are just like silly songs in a Broadway show. Like, I'm getting very self-conscious right now. Yeah,
I created my second masterwork.
Yeah. I mean, we ain't Lennon and McCartney here talking about the White Album.
I mean, part of it is actually you can't be precious about your work in this situation. You can't think, oh, this is my art, because just, you know, every day you're just cutting things and changing things and slashing things out. So, I mean, you know, you just kind of do it and it works. And if it doesn't work, you do something else.
And you've also written stuff for people as they enter the theater and as they leave the theater, kind of advice to them and little slogans.
That was Adam's awesome idea for the overture and the what's it called after the overture? At the end of the show, the underture?
Yeah. Exit music?
The aperture?
Some of the things are, you know, remind me. There were things like, you know, unwrap your lozenges in the beginning.
Well, actually, the way it started is because there are actually legal requirements of announcements that have to be made before a Broadway show starts, you know, about turning off your cell phone and that kind of thing. And I just said, well, you know, it's such a bummer to have some voice come on. Can't we just have the band sing that stuff? And so that developed into this whole thing of having the band kind of shouting instructions at the audience as they enter and exit. And, I would hope that as we go, we could actually keep changing that as we go and maybe mix it up.
Yeah, I mean, but that's like just part of like this – the sense of play that we tried to bring to this, like, we don't care. Like, that seemed like a funny idea. Let's just do it. And we were lucky enough to be allowed to do those kind of things.
Yeah. And we're always pitching ideas that sort of play with the idea of a Broadway show in general. And some of them work and some of them we just go too far. I mean, I had this idea that I wanted to put the bows after the first song. That one obviously didn't fly.
Next show, Adam.
Next show, I'm going to do that. Well, I want to thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
David Javerbaum and Adam Schlesinger wrote the songs for the new Broadway musical Crybaby. It opens next week. Javerbaum is the executive producer of The Daily Show. Schlesinger is the co-leader of the band Fountains of Wayne. They spoke with Fresh Air's rock critic Ken Tucker, who is also editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. Coming up, linguist Jeff Nunberg on the word a more hard-working word than you may have thought. This is Fresh Air. It's one of the most common words in English and one of the most maligned, but it's been doing useful work for centuries, and lately it's acquired a new hip meaning. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg gives us his thoughts on the little word
I always find it disconcerting to hear a tape of myself having a conversation or giving a talk. Do I really say that much? Of course, it's natural to tune out your own tics and twitches when you're speaking, but nothing makes you seem quite as scattered as those ums do. Pause silently in mid-utterance, and you sound deliberate and thoughtful. Drop an into the pause, and you sound hesitant, indecisive, or simply dim. As the author of an early 20th century book on public speaking expressed his condemnation of the word, grunting is no part of thinking. Letter for letter, probably comes in for more disdain than any other item in the English vocabulary. I say item because most people won't even do the courtesy of calling it a word. And some of them actually get indignant when they find out it's in the dictionary. It seems more like a meaningless noise we use to fill out our hesitations, like the hum your hard drive makes while it's trying to retrieve a long file. But clearly is an English word. Speakers of other languages signal their hesitation very differently. In Mandarin, you say nega. In Japanese, you say eto or ano. And in American Sign Language, you circle your forearm with your palm up and your fingers spread. In fact, English speakers have to learn to use and just like they have to learn to use ball or run or grapefruit. The only difference is that when you say and you're not referring to anything in the world, but commenting on your own utterance. That's what makes the words fascinating to psychologists and linguists. You can learn a lot about the way we turn our thoughts into language by looking at where the process breaks down. For a very readable account of all this research, you can turn to a recent book by the science writer Michael Erard with the easy-to-remember title of The book actually covers the whole range of speech slips and blunders from spoonerisms to bushisms, but it's particularly interesting on what you could think of as the umological paradox. On the one hand, and seem to play a useful communicative role. According to the psychologist Herb Clark and Jean Fox Tree, speakers use the words to signal upcoming delays in speech, for a minor delay and for a major one. Depending on the context, those signals might mean that the speaker wants to hold the floor, needs time to search for a word, or has to stop and go back to repair a mispronunciation or mistake. Yet despite its usefulness, people have been putting the knock on for centuries. It was the 16th century versions of and that gave rise to the expression hem and haw to mean dither. And modern critics have been even more censorious of the word, to the point where it's become what Erard calls the emblem of a disorganized mind. Maybe the problem with is that it draws attention to our disfluencies and hesitations. That's especially noticeable when it's used in a context that ordinarily calls for a certain amount of deliberation. Fillers and false starts tend to pass right by us in casual conversation, but they can become maddeningly distracting when we hear somebody using them in a radio interview or political debate. And it may be that modern broadcast media have made us more alert to the overuse of than ever before. But as much as we condemn as an unconscious mark of hesitation, we find it useful to have around when we want to consciously fake that effect. People have always used to introduce a euphemism or circumlocution, as if a sudden twinge of delicacy had forced them to break off their utterance. The media didn't take long to uncover the name of the governor's, date. And in recent years, we've started to see a new use of the word as a mock apology before you correct somebody who says something particularly stupid or does something particularly inappropriate. As in, actually, Ringo was the band's drummer. Or, we don't use that word around here. You run into that pseudo-deferential all over the place these days, not just in speech, but in email, blogs, and news features. It has become a hallmark of a wired style of writing that simulates the spontaneity of real-time communication, hesitations and all. And it also signals a certain shift in attitude. You could think of it as a replacement for the snippy hello that first caught on in the 1980s. That, too, was used to emphasize somebody's utter cluelessness. Hello, Ringo was the band's drummer. But the tone is completely different. Hello oozes condescending ridicule. Is anybody home? Whereas involves a more subtle maneuver. You pretend to be hesitating out of a reluctance to embarrass the person you're correcting. But the hesitation itself makes it pointedly clear that the person has good reason to be chagrined. I don't expect that a lot of people will miss that sarcastic hello when it's finally put out to pasture. And I suppose you could see the apologetic as the harbinger of a new age of ostensible civility. But that isn't exactly the sign of a kinder, gentler English language. All that the new really shows is just how snarky civility can be.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist who teaches at the School of Information at the University of California at Berkeley. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Joan Tui Westman, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, Jonathan Menhivar, and John Sheehan. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, presenting daily book reviews, author interviews, and more in the Barnes & Noble Review, online at bn.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
She danced with John Travolta in Pulp Fiction and fought off dozens of people in Kill Bill. She's the daughter of a scholar of Tibetan Buddhism. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Uma Thurman. She's starring in a new independent film called The Life Before Her Eyes. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.